Okay, good. If I have to sit down, then that's because I have a back problem. So a heat lecturing while sitting down. But if it happens, don't think that something weird is happening. It's because of that. I hope I'll survive for 1.5 hours. The other personal thing is something that you may have seen before, maybe 10 times already. But I'd like to do some shameless advertising. Shameless because I'm involved in this myself, as are 3 other people from the English department. We're giving a concert on the 1st of July. You might think, how stupid can you be to give a concert on the 1st of July? That's the last day of the European Championships. No, it's all synchronized. It's all wonderful. We will be finished by the time the football starts. It's a good way to get into the mood, either because the Italians are playing, then you get some Italian music to get you into the mood. And if the Germans win tonight, then at least there is some Italian involvement on the day. So, yes, you're invited to join us. It's taking place in the Kirche Heiligkreuz. It's €5 for students. Yeah, I always say in this context also, it's pretty much the only opportunity to see me in a black suit and a tie. So if that's what you wanted, what you've always wanted, then you're going to get that there. Okay, some admin. Last week's lecture isn't online yet because I haven't received the slides from Professor Busse yet. I've now asked her. I've got the recording, but I thought the recording without slides doesn't really make much sense. So I guess I'll get it by tomorrow, the latest, I hope. And then I'll upload them together with the audio. Okay, then I know that some of you are stressing yourself out because of the assignment. I see some nods in the lecture. It's easy for me to say that, obviously, but still, I want to say a few words about this. One of the main reasons why I gave you this assignment is because I felt, or because I actually realized, that quite a few students in their 6th semester and beyond had never actually done some practical work with the Oxford English Dictionary or other similar sources. In fact, some people sort of asked, not you, but some people said, what is the Oxford English Dictionary once? Okay, and I was a bit shocked. So I thought I'll do an assignment where you have to actively be involved in sort of, well, either physically leafing through sheets of paper, but of course everyone has realized that it's available online and that there are wonderful ways of searching the OED. You can use the timelines feature to restrict your searches to particular periods of the time, periods in the history of the English language, etc., etc. So that's the reason why I've done this. But please don't consider this to be a PhD or something like that. My idea is to get you working on a number of these words and to find out how the tools can be used. And it's not supposed to be perfect. I mean, don't just write down nonsense, of course. But it's not the kind of data that you would need for a fully fledged term paper of 20 pages if you're doing an MA or something like that. So I don't want to belittle it, but I also don't want you to work for hours and hours and hours and hours on this. On the other hand, it is supposed to be 60 hours worth of work. So we are trying to make sure that credit points are worth what they're worth, okay? So I couldn't just give you something which is done in 2 hours. In fact, in the first year lecture, I'm being very lenient there because people also get quite a few credit points for the assignments that can be done really very quickly. But here I felt, just out of fairness also to the other people who are not doing this, I have to ask for a little bit more, okay? Some people have asked me to let you know how to quote the BNC, the BNC or BNC Web. If you want to put this into the references, then that's one way of doing it. There are 5 different ways of doing it. Again, I don't really, well, it's not that I don't mind, but just do something which makes sense. This is one thing which could make sense. It's a reference to BNC Web, which you could give. How do you quote examples from the BNC itself? Well, you could I mean, not by any chance, not by any chance, in any case, number the examples if you need to, give them in the text, and then you can add the text ID that's given in the corpus and the sentence unit number, and that is then a unique way of referring to it if you want to give examples. Okay? Any other immediate questions about the assignment and other related things? Good. Okay. Then, this lecture has two parts. We're going to talk about the Bible and we're going to talk about dictionaries, both texts that are influential in some way or other in the history of the English language. This is one reason why I've combined them. Also, this is not going to be a highly theoretical lecture. You got something really pretty tough from me 2 weeks ago, where we had a whole lecture on grammaticalization theory and on mechanisms of language change, etc. This is more of sort of an overview of the development of biblical texts and the kind of influence that it has. Well, actually, I've got a slide here to highlight the influence that an English version of the Bible has had upon the English language, okay, related to power and prestige of the text as such. And I'll also mention a few of the political events that went hand in hand with this or influenced the development of the Bible and, of course, therefore, also in turn, the development of the English language. That's what we're doing in the first part. And in the second part, I'll then give you an overview of different dictionaries from the very first dictionaries in the 16th, beginning of the 17th century to, well, what we have today. Okay. Yes, let's return to the Bible, though, first. Someone has once said, and I'm saying someone has once said because I can't place the reference anymore. It's one of those things that you hate when you write term papers, right? You wrote it down somewhere, and you know it's not your reference. It's not you haven't done this yourself, but you can't find it anymore. I've Googled it, etc. Someone once said, and I think they were right, and I can't tell you who it was, the history of the Bible translation is the history or the history of Bible translation is the history of the English language and its usage, because they are very tightly sort of intertwined, so to speak. We can see some of the history of the general language in the history of the English language and vice versa. I don't know how much you know about the Bible. What's the original language of the Bible? Yes, in some parts are in Aramaic. It's Hebrew for the Old Testament, and some elements, I mean, there's some disagreement also as well, but some parts are in Aramaic, but generally speaking, it's Hebrew in the Old Testament. Okay. So a Semitic language. And then in the New Testament, Greek, yes. Okay, yeah. Not Latin, as quite a few people sometimes assume. Okay. Yes, and in fact, the Greek was not the kind of classical Greek that you might learn if you do classical Greek today, but it's much more sort of a common Greek, a Koine Greek, actually. And in fact, some people early on almost poked fun at the language of the Bible back then, because it was considered to be a fairly sort of basic way of using language. Okay, so it's not the classical Greek that we find today. Yes, and then of course we have Latin as an important language as well, but we'll come to that in a minute. Let's quickly look at the Old English period. Remember that the Anglo-Saxons were converted to Christianity in the 7th century, and that is also the time from which we have the very earliest manuscripts, and it's got this. There's a clear link between the earliest Old English manuscripts that we have and Christianity. Without Christianity, we wouldn't have Old English texts, or at least not for a while, presumably. Okay. The official language back then was Latin. Okay. And again, not sort of classical Latin, but based on the Vulgate. Okay. Written in 4th century Latin. Okay. Yes. Now, what happened to the Latin in English? Well, for a long time, very little. Okay? In fact, what we seem to have, or all that we have for a long time, is basically glosses. So, handwritten anyway, because there was no printing press yet, but handwritten comments between lines or next to lines that would basically help the people using the Bible to make sense of what it means. Okay. So there were actually quite a few clerics who did not know Latin well enough, and they needed help. And that's basically the only remnants of the Bible in English for the Old English period that we have. There was never a full translation of the Bible into Old English. What did it look like? What did it sound like? I already gave you some Old English texts early on. Let's have a look at the text which I presume virtually everyone in this room, or I guess everyone, will be familiar with. It's the Lord's Prayer in Old English, you're familiar with the Lord's Prayer in Modern English, I would expect. But anyway, this is what it looked like. Okay. I'm not going to read you the whole thing. Feder ure dude eardon hevonum. Sidin nama jehalchot. Tobekume din rice. Je wurde din villa on eordan swaswa on hevonum. You can sort of make out some words which are similar to, English and German, of course. Just to revise a few points that I made in the very early lectures of this lecture course, we've got words which are, of course, Germanic and which will be shared with German, with modern German today. Reich, okay, as we've got here. Then we've got Erlöse uns, okay, Alus, okay. Then we've also got words which have died out in the meantime. Kostnung, okay, here. That meant trial, but also temptation, which is the word that we have today. It's actually related to the German word kosten. Okay. So we see the links there. We also have, do you know chlaf? Do you know any word in English that sounds like chlaf? What is this? The daily bread? Yes, the loaf. Yeah. So that's related to this. Okay. And we have, and this is why I highlighted this here, we've got the inflectional endings, which were then largely lost by the modern English period. Okay. This is a bit of a revision, just in case your memory needs refreshing. This is the modern version of the Lord's Prayer. In fact, it's not the most modern version, but it's the one that you find in the Book of Common Prayers, the Lord's Prayer in Modern English. So you have Our Father who art in heaven. Of course, this is in itself a fairly old-fashioned and archaic way of phrasing things. I'll mention something about this a bit later on, whether the language in the Bible is actually something that had an innovating function or actually a preserving function of archaic texts. Okay, I won't read this out to you. I kind of expect you to know this. If not in English, then at least it'll be easy to link to what you know in German. Okay, what's the language of the Bible in Middle English? Well, it's still a Latin translation. Okay, and it stayed so for quite some time. And it's quite interesting to see the relevance of the Bible for the people at that time. It was a very important book. Church attendance was compulsory. Okay. But the book itself was closed in the sense that it was not available to be read by many people at all. I mean, very, very few people indeed. There was the Council of Toulouse. I'm not a history person, so I don't have a lot of background on some of the historical events that I'm going to mention today. But the Council of Toulouse was very important in many ways, related to the Inquisition. Okay, it was a sort of they set up a sort of an ecclesiastical tribunal. Okay, this Inquisition. The idea was that they were searching out and then trying heretics who were not following the kind of beliefs that they were supposing was the only way to do it. Okay, and They were also giving a lot of power to laymen who were supposed to find out things about their, well, people living in the same place and then report on them, and a lot of their houses were destroyed as a result of this, etc. Not a very nice period, I guess, for a lot of people there. And they actually prohibited everyone who wasn't a priest or who wasn't specifically trained or to do this, to from possessing the Bible and from reading the Bible. Okay. So it could only be read by priests, and in fact not really allowed. Okay. So it was a very closed book. Also at that period, quite a few of the people who were allowed to read it, they didn't actually know Latin sufficiently well. So it was something which is really, really restricted to a very, very small group of people, but of course had a very strong influence, nevertheless, on their daily lives. Okay? But not in the sense that people could actually go and read it up. There's an interesting survey which was done by the Bishop of Gloucester, who looked at 311 bishops, or asked them, bishops, deacons, and archdeacons, and about half of them were unable to read the Ten Commandments in Latin. Okay? Not in English, because there was no version in English. 31 of them didn't know which book the Ten Commandments are recorded in. 40 couldn't even repeat the Lord's Prayer in Latin. So this sort of shows that clearly even the people who were supposed to have access to the book couldn't actually make sense of it in many ways. This is the kind of general situation. And then came someone whose name you might have heard before, John Wycliffe. Okay, and the Wycliffe Bible is obviously the book or the version of the Bible that is known under his name. Okay. And the Lollards, I mean, are these terms, who had heard of Wycliffe before? Okay, few people, very few people. Okay. He was of the opinion that it shouldn't be a closed book. It should be a book that should be readable by everyone. In fact, his argument was that, well, Christ was speaking the language of the Bible in that sense and taught in the local language. Why should not men now do so? Okay. And he was then responsible. It's not his only, I mean, it wasn't his work alone, but he was responsible for the production of the first Bible in English. Okay. There were two versions. None of them was authorized. In fact, he was considered to be a heretic by many of his contemporaries and the official church. And he was prosecuted for it. Okay. People believe that Chaucer knew Wycliffe or about Wycliffe and introduced him into the prologue of the Canterbury Tales. A good man was there of religion. That was a poor person of a town. Okay. But rich he was of holy thought and work. He was also a learned man, a clerk. That Christ's gospel truly would preach. Okay. And then a bit later on, this noble ensemble of his sheep, to his sheep he gave, okay, sheep, that first he wrought and after that he taught. A better priest, nowhere none is, and I believe that nowhere that is nowhere, okay, we've got the nice double negative again. He waited after no pomp, nor reverence, okay. He was a simple person, etc., etc. Stop reading here. That's taken usually as, by some people, to mean that Chaucer had had some sympathy for Wycliffe and his teachings. There were some problems involved in translating the Bible, though, because it's, okay, religious language, of course, but there was a very clear connection between, well, God's truth and the word that was used to transfer that truth. Okay. The problem is that when you do this, and when you translate the Bible, and this is still obviously the case today, is this actually something that we can do and still represent God's word? And as a result of this, they were very careful, okay, particularly in the first translation. The result of this meant saw many structures and many words that would not actually, people believe, be a reflection of the way people spoke at that time. There were things like this, "Lord, go from me, for I am a man sinner." Okay. Which would have been, I mean, obviously with a modern way of spelling, etc., but which would have been a way that looked unfamiliar, that would have looked unfamiliar even to to people at that time, as it does to us today. But it's basically a word-by-word translation from the Latin source that it was translated from. Okay. It also made use of a lot of Latin words simply in order not to sort of mess with the meaning. Okay, it was too dangerous. So a lot of the words that entered at that time can actually be traced to this Bible translation. About 1,000 Latin words. So words like emperor, justice, profession, city, cradle, suddenly, etc., etc. What did the Lord's Prayer look like in Middle English? I'll just give you a minute to read this for yourself. It's getting closer, right, to what we know today. Notice we now have kingdom, which is actually an Anglo-Saxon word, but which is really only found once in a poem in the 7th century, if I remember correctly, and is actually starting to be used only in Middle English. We also have clear loan words from French, temptation and deliver. Okay. So this is from the Wycliffe Bible. Interestingly, we have a second version as well of the Wycliffe Bible, which is probably a separate translation. And this one is much more idiomatic, okay, much less directly related to the Latin origin. Okay. There are some word order changes which are, if you compare this to the earlier version of the Wycliffe Bible. It also, it has an interesting introductory paragraph or treatise which explains how the people involved in translating this, the kind of techniques that they used. And they make the point, I mean, not explicitly like this, but it's basically no longer a word by word, but more a sense by sense translation. So some things moved quite quickly there as well. Now, one of the interesting questions in the context of the Bible translations is the connection with the standard and an evolving standard of the English language. We talked about standardization to some extent. We talked about Caxton, the printing press. We talked about the Chancery English, which introduced certain standardizations and which then basically, over a period of several centuries, in fact, led to what we now today know as Standard English. The Bible, and the Bible in its different translations, have had some impact, people believe, on the spread of a certain type of standard as well. Now, in fact, when we talk about Wycliffe, we're talking about a period which is, in fact, earlier than the development of Standard English, but you sort of must remember that it was, well, not remember, but it's basically a bestseller in its day. There were quite a few of these Bibles produced, and they would have been read, they would have been, they were distributed across England, and people would have been exposed to it, and therefore, by way of being exposed to it, it would have had, to some extent, a standardizing force. It also clearly increased the literacy, the level of literacy among the lower social classes. Okay, the people associated with Wycliffe are usually called the Lollards, which is, it basically, people debate about this, but it probably means muttrer, okay, who then introduced the word of God directly to the people. Did the official church like this? No, obviously not. Okay, there was a show trial of Wycliffe in 1382. All the Bibles were banned. And this is also an interesting observation in the context of standardization. If the official part of a government or of a country is actually against something which I've just said has a standardizing effect, then this isn't the kind of climate that leads towards further standardization, because it is not the prestige variety, or it cannot develop into a prestige variety. Okay. So, yes, to a certain extent, an influence in the standardization, or in the very, very early stages of standardization, possibly, of a standard in English, but really not to the extent that many later aspects like Caxton's printing press, etc., would have had. Okay, what happened afterwards? In 1408, we have the following: that no man hereafter, by his own authority, translate any text of the scripture into English or any other tongue by way of a book, booklet, or tract, and that no man read any such book, booklet, or tract, now lately composed in the time of John Wycliffe or since, or hereafter to be set forth in part or in whole, publicly or privately, upon pain of greater excommunication, until the said translation be approved by the ordinary of the place, or in the case of, or if the case so require, by the council provincial. He that shall do contrary to this shall likewise be punished as a favor of heresy and error, which was not something that you wanted to be accused of back then. So it looked as if the whole thing had basically closed down again. But then remember, this was the time when English got revived. Okay? We have Chaucer and others, but we also have the royalty, moving over to English. Okay, Henry V, he wrote, well, from his dealings in France, he wrote them home in English. Okay. And that's where English regains its power that it had, or its influence that it had in earlier periods in Old English. Okay. And that's where we get Chancery English, etc., and some of those things that I've said, that I've mentioned before, and we've got the invention of the printing press, etc., etc. So even though there was sort of a low point at the beginning of the 15th century, we then have a development where English is becoming much more important again, and that will eventually, in fact, show in the Bible as well. Tyndale, 1525. This is a translation of the New Testament into English, and this is actually the first translation which is from the original. Okay. That sounds like nothing, not good news for tonight's football, right? Okay. Yes, okay. It's a translation into English from the original language, and he also, gosh, can you still hear me? Good, okay. I defy the Pope and all his laws, and if God spares me, I will one day make the boy that drives the plow in England to know more of the scriptures than the Pope does. Okay. So he quite clearly was on a collision way with the Catholic Church there, with the Church. Okay. In fact, this was, as I said, shortly after the introduction of the printing press, two generations or so, but in fact it had to be printed on the continent, and they were smuggled into England after 1526. And in fact the whole country was put on alert. It was a very serious thing to do. It was a political thing, really. This is what the earliest version looked like. Okay. So it's clearly printed now. What does the Lord's Prayer... Do I need to move over there, or can you still hear me? You can still hear me. Okay, yeah. Well, you there, yes, but in the back? Okay, good. Lord's Prayer in early modern English. Our Father, which art in heaven. Okay. something that you still see in some versions in Britain as well. Okay, the which rather than who. Okay, but this is really very close now to what we have in the version that I read to you. It's bothering me, actually. Is it bothering you? Gosh. Yes. Okay, I'll try anyway. It must be pretty dramatic outside. Okay. Is that better? I'll hold this here a little bit. Okay. So I don't need to shout. Okay, what happened later? So in this period, obviously, because it was against the law, etc., these Bibles were confiscated, were burned. That's also why not many of them actually survive today. And then we've got Henry VIII. I don't know how much you know about Henry VIII. One thing you might know is that he had six wives. Okay, and all of this is related, of course, to the English Reformation in some way or other. Okay. It's getting worse. Okay. It all really started with his wish to get rid of wife number one. Okay. And he wanted the Pope to annul this marriage, and the Pope didn't want to do this. Okay. But he then forced the highest member of the church in England to do this anyway, which led to a, break with Rome. Gosh, this is getting very... I think this is the first time I've ever had anything like this. I'll try. Okay. So a break with Rome, the Catholic Church and what was to become the Anglican Church separating from each other. And that was also then in 1536, a time when Tyndale, who was still being prosecuted, was found guilty and he was killed. And ironically, this was very shortly before something happened that he actually wished, as a last sort of his last prayer, was that God might open the King of England's eyes. Okay, because that happened quite soon afterwards. When Henry VIII marries his third wife, okay, at this time a lot of the Catholic monasteries were dissolved. Okay. He also instituted Cromwell, which will be a name that you know. And he was then, shortly after really, only a few years after, instructed to organize a printing of the first official Bible, okay, which is called the Great Bible, which was distributed across the country. Every church was ordered to have one of those. Yeah. Ironically, this is actually based on Tyndale's work to a very large extent. History becomes very messy then. We've got the return to Catholicism, and then later on, of course, the change back to the Anglican Church. Several Bibles were produced at that time. The most influential one was the Geneva Bible, which was actually a Bible that was produced by people who had to flee the British Isles. And that's when Geneva became one of the centers of religious thought. And then, and I'm going to stop here with the history of the Bibles, pretty much. In 1611 is what's known today, the date where the King James Bible, as it's still known today, was printed for the first time. There are many, many versions, or many, many reprints, obviously, of the King James Bible. Interestingly, people disagree about this, but about 80% of this is actually based on Tyndale's translation. So the person who was prosecuted for doing this. Okay, we'll have a mini break in a few minutes. Then we can see what it looks outside. Okay. Linguistic influence of the Bible, or in fact of Tyndale's translation. Now, you're not native speakers of English, okay? But even non-native speakers of English will probably know quite a few of the of the words or the phrases that came into English as a result of this translation. Let there be light. The truth shall make you free. Am I my brother's keeper? The powers that be. Okay. You talk about the people in charge, you talk about the powers that be. Let my people go. Blessed are the peacemakers, the signs of the times. Eat, drink, and be merry, etc. All of these are straight out of Tyndale's Bible translation. They have become, part of the idiomatic inventory of English today. Okay. Now, my English students, some of them actually knew this, but I suspect that very few of you might. Do you know what a whited sepulchre is? Do you? Yeah? Yeah? Yes, it's related to that. It's a tomb or a burial place, a building vault. So it's not the whole cemetery, but it's yeah, okay. Or excavation made for the interment, yeah, of a human body. Okay, that's the definition from the OED. Now, in biblical language, it is used figuratively. To read here, for a hypocrite, or one whose fair outward semblance conceals inward corruption. That's how it was used in Tyndale's Bible. Now, nowadays, people who do not know that this is from the Bible will use it idiomatically in English, as many other idioms that have come down from Tyndale's translation. So it's part of the idiomatic inventory of English, and it's not just a quotation. If it was a quotation, people would be aware of the fact that it is from the Bible. But if you say, eat, drink, and be merry, well, many will know the biblical reference, but perhaps just as many nowadays may not know that it's a biblical reference. It's just part of the idiomatic inventory of the English language. At the same time, it was actually a fairly conservative way of using the language. He did not innovate in the sense that he brought in a lot of new entries in something like the Oxford English Dictionary. We only find about 120 of them, and many of these words are actually fairly basic or transparent, okay, broken-hearted. Well, we had broken before, we had heart before, and broken-hearted sort of makes sense. Yeah? It's something that's new, but it's not something that's specifically new, I would say. Follow soldier, rose-colored, long-suffering, etc. Yeah? So they're transparent compounds. Tyndale, interested in reaching the plowboy rather than the professor, was no lexical innovator. Yeah? But nevertheless, because of all this, I mean, the idiomatic elements, etc., Tyndale is said to have had a huge influence on the English language. Some people say that he's had more influence on the way we speak than anyone except Shakespeare. Perhaps it's in fact the other way around, because a lot of the things that are in Shakespeare are actually probably based on Tyndale as well. So he's not a creator of the standard, but again, as before, as I've mentioned before, it's by way of being exposed to this kind of language frequently, again and again, the spread of a standard will have been supported. What happened since 1611? Well, we've had many, many more Bible translations, of course, in many languages, other than English, of course, as well, but also for English or different Englishes around the world. The debate about how to translate the Bible is still very much alive. Why? Well, obviously because translation, and you know this, when you do it, translation courses with our Sprachpraxis people, you know that translation involves interpretation and you have different strategies for doing this. Just to give you some examples, I mean, if you go back to the original Greek, then you've got a word which meant gathering or assembly of people. You can translate this in different ways. You can say church, or you can say congregation. Whether you say church or congregation has different religious implications. Both make sense. Okay. Or this word here, this is actually older man, but you can also say priest. And depending on how you do this, again, it's a different religious message. So the linguistic choices that were made, or that are made today, but that were made in different history, elements of the history of the English language, what? Now I can't blame the rain, but anyway, were highly relevant for the development of the language as such, in the context of a book that had, of course, for a very long time, and still has to some extent today, an enormous impact on the lives of people. Okay. So that was the overview of the Bible and the connection with different stages of the history in the English language. A bit early today, but let's have a few minutes of a break anyway and see whether the world outside still exists. Just 2 minutes.
Ich kann mich dann erinnern, aber ich meine
nicht. Ich will jetzt nicht schauen, weil manchmal passiert das mir, dass Leute sagen, ja, ich habe geantwortet. Und ich das eigentlich nicht gefragt, also ich schaue in meinen gesendeten Orten, in den dann entschuldige ich mich.
Okay. Okay. Is the world still? Yeah. All right. Let's move over to dictionaries. All of you have used a dictionary, of course. And we just take them for granted today, right? You use them on a daily basis, I guess, or many of you will do this. But this wasn't always the case, of course. I mean, people didn't use books on a daily basis, of course. And one of the questions perhaps that we could start asking ourselves, and I'm not going to discuss this in any great detail, what the purpose of a dictionary is. Perhaps also in the context of this discussion of standardization and the difference between prescription and description. Now, I'm not going to go over that difference again. I kind of assume that this is clear to you. But in any case, the kind of dictionaries that we had, or that people used in different stages of the history of the language, can be related to different well, to different attitudes towards the language and therefore the time in which they were written, not only from a linguistic point of view, but also from a social point of view, etc. So things like levels of literacy, we also see the influence of the printing press, etc. So many of the points that I've mentioned before, I would like to return to, at least to some extent, when we look at a quick overview of the history of dictionaries. Okay. Now, in a way, you could say the very earliest glosses in biblical texts or in religious texts were some kind of dictionaries in the sense that they helped people in the translation or in the understanding of the language of Latin, if their Latin wasn't good enough. Okay. Now, that's in a way some sort of dictionary, at least it's got a similar function. We also then soon, or fairly soon, had bilingual dictionaries, okay, something that you will have used quite a lot as well. So, for example, English to Latin, well, Latin to English, really, but English to Latin as well. Promptorium Parvulorum. My Latin is very rusty, okay? So I won't even read the second part here. Okay, gosh, okay. Anyway, which contained about 12,000 entries. Okay, so fairly extensive, around 1440. Caxton was involved with dictionaries as well. He created and printed a French-English dictionary, which was specifically aimed at travelers, around 1480. Okay. And then there was a whole boom in the Renaissance in bilingual dictionaries, for example. Well, partly, of course, because that was a time when people explored other areas in Europe and then beyond. A lot of people will have traveled to Italy and therefore needed an English-Italian dictionary. But they're bilingual dictionaries. And we know, I mean, the OED today is not a bilingual dictionary. Then there was Mulcaster, okay, who wrote an elementary published in 1582, and this is what it looked like, which had a pedagogical purpose. He wanted to, this is the time when English became enriched. Okay? It was still Latin that was the language of science, but still. Okay? He was of the opinion that English was worthy to be used for all kinds of purposes. Here is a quote from him. "I don't think that any language, be it whatsoever, is better able to utter all arguments either with more pith or greater plainness than our English tongue is. If the English utterer be as skillful in the matter which he is to utter." So you need to know what you're doing with English and then you'll be fine. For that purpose, I'm not quite sure how this actually helped, but anyway, he thought that he would publish a list of 8,000 words that were sort of an inventory of the language to be used, I suppose. Okay. Some of them are very common today. Others are a bit odd. Carpet knight, Flindermouse, etc. And most importantly, because if you're wondering what this is, well, there were no definitions. So it's not really a dictionary in the same sense as we have it today. This is what it looked like. So it was a long list of words, basically. Blossom. Blot, blondie, etc. So, and as I said, the intention was to make sure that English could be used in a more straightforward and direct and also consistent way. He disapproved of the fact that it looked to him as if English was written without any certain direction. And he felt that people from outside were actually looking at English or at the way they were written as something bad. Okay. He was also, in that sense, it was some kind of spelling reform which he propagated. So he consistently spelt certain words where there was a lot of variation before. Okay. But it wasn't a dictionary. Okay. He was aware of the fact that it would be helpful to have a dictionary. And he, in fact, himself wrote the following: "It were a thing very praiseworthy, in my opinion, if someone well-learned and as laborious a man, as he is learned, would gather all the words which we use in our English tongue out of all professions, as well-learned as not, into one dictionary, and besides the right writing, which is incident to the alphabet, would open unto us therein both their natural force and their proper use. Okay? Proper use, and we're beginning to see also aspects of prescriptivism perhaps here, okay, as something that is desirable. But he didn't do it. Well, the person who did it was Robert Cawdrey. Okay. He wrote the Table Alphabetical in 1604, which is the first single language dictionary ever published in English. Okay. It wasn't as extensive as the OED, as you can imagine. It contained about 3,000 words, and there were definitions, and that's what makes it into a first dictionary. This was a time when, as I said, the language was enriched in various ways. We've also got the development of the sciences in all sorts of directions, and Latin, which was still very important, then lost some of its importance because English became more usable in this context. Okay. The explanations were basically his own. They were not, as will be later the case, based on, quotations from great writers of the day. Okay. Also, something that is very common that you're currently dealing with if you're doing the assignment, the etymologies. I forgot to press this. Okay. Well, anyway, let's see. I pressed the wrong button. Anyway, I'll have the audio here, and I hope I can extract it from there. The etymologies, the histories of the words, are also not given. Okay. He wrote, this is from the cover page and the introduction, and it shows what it is used for, or who the target audience is. A table alphabetical containing and teaching the true writing and understanding of hard usual English words borrowed from the Hebrew, Greek, Latin, or French, and others, with the interpretation thereof by plain English words gathered for the benefit and help of ladies, gentlewomen, or any other unskillful persons. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whereby they may be made the more easily and better understand many hard English words which they shall hear or read in scriptures, sermons, or elsewhere, and also be made able to use the same aptly themselves. So it isn't the kind of dictionary that we have today where very common words are used or explained, but it's a dictionary of hard words. Okay. This is what it looked like. So, poet, a verse master. Okay. What else do we have? Polygamy, having more wives than one, etc. So very simple, very straightforward definitions. Okay, more dictionaries came to be printed. And by the way, no, you do not need to learn all those names and dates and whatever and things like that by heart. That's certainly not the idea. Okay, so don't worry. Okay. This is just to give you an idea that this is something that took off. Okay. And then, of course, also just to show you the kind of diversity that became, that started to develop. We've got Glossographia in 1656, which was much more extensive, but it also included many of the recent loanwords. Yeah. And it is the first dictionary which included definitions included descriptions of etymologies. Okay, so the history of words. This is, again, what it looked like. Probably can't read this. Let's see. There is a word which many of you will know, homonymy. Okay. Homonymy is from Greek, when diverse things are signified by one word or name. Okay, as heart signifies a beast and a principal member of the body. So that probably takes you back to the introductory lecture, or at least it should. But it also included many of the foreign borrowings or terms. Oni soit qui mal y pense, signifies evil or shame to him that evil thinks. Yeah. something that we can still use today in English. It included words like coffee, a kind of drink among the Turks and Persians, and of late introduced among us, which is black, thick, and bitter. Okay. Also more common words, but again, common words. No, coffee is common nowadays as well. But anyway, imagine you stood upon Highgate or the Tower Hill at Greenwich, so far as you may see round about as in a circle, where the heaven seems to touch the earth, that is called the horizon. Do you know what a honeymoon is? A plight to those married persons that love well at first and decline in affections afterwards. It is honey now, but it will change as the moon. Okay. This is actually fairly similar to the definition given in the OED as sort of the background of how this word developed. Right, so we've got etymologies, we've got definitions, and we've got many, many more words than we used to have before. More dictionaries. In fact, also dictionaries of specialized vocabulary. Counting Academy. It's a sort of one of like the first slang dictionary. Okay. And as many of these types of dictionaries were intended to be, this was to make sure that people were aware of the words that they were not supposed to use themselves, or that they could decipher them if they were exposed to them and it was actually dangerous to them. Right? Numbers rise, okay. 28,000 words in 1602. Okay. This is John Kersey. A new English dictionary or a complete collection of the most proper, okay, and significant words commonly used in the language with a short and clear exposition of difficult words in terms of art. Notice commonly used in the language. Mm-hmm. Who is it for? The whole digested into alphabetical order and chiefly designed for the benefit of young scholars, tradesmen, artificers. Oh, anyway, sorry. And the female sex, again. Who would learn to spell truly, being so fitted to every capacity that it may be a continual help to all that want an instructor? So, common words like woman. Okay. Not entirely the right way of sort of working out the etymology. Look it up in the OED. Okay, it's actually not too far away in some ways. Okay, so it's the first dictionary to include everyday words. So words like but if, and but yet, to and fro, etc. We also had a universal etymological dictionary, about 40,000 words. Okay. And we now further and further get into this kind of, well, prescriptive view of looking at words that are good to be used, approved authority, etc., and they are supposed to be imitated by the illiterate, okay, etc. 48,000 words. And they included, this particular one included words that were then purged later and still are purged in many American dictionaries later, even today. Well, not quite to that extent anymore, but American dictionaries tend to be fairly prudish, right? Depends, exactly, depends, yeah. But it's a cliche, but it was actually for a very long period the case. What was it? Professor Stubbs keeps telling a nice story that I've now forgotten about a dictionary that came out, I think it was in the American context, and was it Webster? I can't remember. Anyway, the story goes something like, a woman commending or commenting on the fact, or positively on the fact, that all the nasty words were not published in the dictionary, and the person who published it then saying, no, in fact, they're not, but I find it interesting that you were looking for them in the first place. So this wasn't exactly how the story goes. I'll look it up. Maybe I'll mention it next time. Okay. Big name, Samuel Johnson. Dictionary of the English Language. Okay, I mentioned Noah Webster in the American context before. I'm not going to talk about him today. Johnson's dictionary has, in many ways, a similar influence at different levels, but it's also a massive work of similar types of influence. Okay, he came up with a plan in 1747 when he actually still thought that he could fix the language, okay, according to what was supposed to be good or the best usage. First edition came out in 1755. He soon realized that the language couldn't be fixed, and therefore his plan in a way changed, or his purpose changed. He didn't want to form the language, but basically to just describe it or to register how it is used. He realized that language change cannot be stopped. This is what it looked like. This is the first volume. It's in two volumes. And here you see, you'll see a better one in a minute. To list the best in English usage, so he wanted to set up a model. Okay? A model not in the sense of creating the model, but so that the model could be used for future reference. Okay? He was not a supporter of the Académie Française. Remember, there were some people who wanted to introduce a similar academy in the English context. He wasn't one of them. As I said, initially he may have been, but then later on he felt that the lexicographer is not someone who sort of keeps the language in an earlier stage of the language, but just basically describes what's going on. What makes his dictionary special? Well, it's not a dictionary for women who can't read or who don't know enough. It's not a dictionary for special use, etc., but it's just basically for the general reader, as most dictionaries, many dictionaries are today. He specifically didn't want to use or to list every single word that could be listed, but he consciously restricted himself to the primary words, as he phrased it, sort of in use and in importance. He also introduced something which was to become which was new at that time, but which we still see today in the OED, namely when we have several meanings of words, he would list the literal first, and then the more sort of abstract or metaphorical meanings or senses afterwards. This is something that we still have today in the OED, and that leads to a situation where the first entry in the in the OED may not actually reflect the most common one today. Maybe a meaning that has in fact even gone out of use. There are a lot of studies about how he did it, what he did, and what he didn't do, etc. But he is well known for his definitions as well, and I'll give you a few. They were very concise. Okay. We've seen similar ones early on, but I mean, he's particularly good at this. A name quadruped used in war, in draft, and in carriage. This is a horse. It's quite concise. A cough. A convulsion of the lungs, velicated by some sharp ferocity. It is pronounced cough. So this is sort of, he's making use of what would have been inkhorn terms not that long ago at that time. Okay. But this is sort of his aim, to be very short and precise. He also introduced some nice lexicographical fun. One of his most famous definitions is oats. A grain which in England is generally given to horses, but in Scotland supports the people. Okay. Or what is a lexicographer? Well, a harmless drudge. Okay, what did he do? He used, he had the meanings, he had the definitions, as we've seen before, but he is also the first to use quotations, as we see it today in the OED. And he used a lot of the quotations from the best writers of the English language, as people considered them to be, Shakespeare, Milton, Spencer, Chaucer, etc. He used about 114,000 of them, sometimes quite liberally, making changes that perhaps shouldn't have happened, but anyway he did. And he also included, in fact, contrary to what we might expect from his nasty quote or nasty definition, some of the Scottish writers, okay? And thereby giving them a voice, an official voice or a place in the English language. I said I was going to show you what it looked like. Well, this is a short extract or a close-up from the dictionary. As you can see, very similar in many ways to what we have today in many dictionaries. And then we had the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, which was started more than 150 years ago. There were several committees that were appointed. There were some important presentations or lectures in the context of this. If you're interested in the story or the history of the OED, I can give you some interesting references there. There is no time to look at this in detail. This is from the preface. The present work aims at exhibiting the history and signification of the English words now in use or known to have been in use since the middle of the 12th century. We exclude all words that have become obsolete by 1150. But to words actually included, this date has no application. So we've got words that were used in Old English, and therefore we have quotations from Old English. The history is exhibited from the first appearance, however early. Down to the 15th century, the language existed only in dialects, all of which had a literary standing. During this period, therefore, words and forms of all dialects are admitted on an equal footing into the dictionary, even though some of the dialects, in a way, have very little to do with what we have today in modern English. Okay, brief overview of the history. 1858 was an important date where sort of it was commissioned. Several societies being formed, Murray being appointed as a full-time editor. Okay. It was going to be published with Oxford University Press, and it was published in installments. Okay. 1884, the first installment, starting with the letter A, started. Murray died in 1915, and it was only by 1928 that the publication was complete. So quite a long time, but dictionaries do tend to take time. That's also very common today. 415,000 words, about 5 million quotations that were provided by many people from, well, it's an interesting story how they were provided, or they were basically sent in by people who were paid to do so, but also a lot of people were asked to just, if they wanted to send in quotations, that they could do so. It was a major feat in pre-computer age, of course. We have wonderful pictures of the scriptorium, where you can see sort of huge shelves full of boxes with slips of paper that were cut out from books, etc. About 2 million of them actually were introduced or included in the text. Then we had a reissue as a single printing, 1933, and then a supplement to bring it up to date. And we have several other supplements in installment. And then, 1988, a first electronic version came out, which is, I think, pretty much lost. I think people are not, simply not, no one owns it anymore, I've been told. Second edition was published in 1989, extended, okay, 616,000 words, head words, okay, and derivatives. 2.5 million or 2.4 million quotations. And then we've got the electronic version, which I actually used. I remember that, the second electronic version on CD-ROM. The OED Online, which you're using, was introduced 12 years ago. And they're currently working on the OED 3, the third edition, which is estimated to be complete in 2037. Okay, quite a way to go. It will probably, I would expect, never be printed, but I don't know. Right, that was a bit of a history. It's a wonderful resource, that's why I'm asking you to use it. But it's also in some way controversial. Okay. The idea is that every word is explained in context of a quotation, but of course the choice of quotations influences things. Okay. For example, there is an over-representation of Shakespeare, which gives him much more weight, as he is commonly given, than perhaps he is due, or not. Well, don't know. We also have a very clear underrepresentation of non-British speakers. Okay. So of the British Empire, also of Australian English, etc., etc. It is very, very much based on literary language. There are non-literary quotations as well, but it is a clear minority, at least in many contexts. If you're interested in the composition of the quotations and what to do with them and what the pros and cons, etc., are, then there's a link here which you can look at. There's also an interesting book about the problematic aspects of the OED. I also did some work myself on the OED in what way it can be used as a corpus, the quotations, because, well, we basically have about 35 million words of quotations from the very beginning of the history of the language to today, and as a corpus linguist, I would want to use them quantitatively. And I looked at the pros and cons of doing this. If you're interested, I can send you an electronic version of this. Okay. The person behind this link is Charlotte Brewer. This is a project of hers, which she's been working on for a long time now, and she's got a whole lot of charts and a lot of interesting information about parts of the OED. So, for example, she's plotting here the number of quotations we have per decade. So you can see that it's a very uneven picture. Of course, it's also an uneven picture what was produced, what was printed, depending on certain things like wars or whether there was a printing press to start with, etc. We see some clear peaks. Here we've got Shakespeare with 33,300 quotations alone. Okay. Here is a list of the contributors that are extremely important or well represented, and you can see that Shakespeare is by far the most frequent contributor. Okay. And some people have said this is slightly problematic. It also, of course, represents the kind of innovation that was introduced or is said to be to have introduced have been introduced by Shakespeare. Okay, the final dictionary I'd like to talk about just for a few minutes, and then I'm going to let you off early again today, is the Collins Cobuild English Language Dictionary, which I suppose many of you will have in some form or other been exposed to. And that's where we're getting to what's very common today, namely the corpus-based dictionaries. And if you've been to any of Professor Stubbs's lectures or classes, then you will perhaps, not in every course, of course, but you will have been exposed to this in much more detail. For the first time, a dictionary has been compiled by the thorough examination of a representative group of English texts, spoken and written, running to many million words. This means that in addition to all the tools of the conventional dictionary makers, wide reading and experience of English, other dictionaries, and of course eyes and ears, this dictionary is based on hard, measurable evidence. No major uses are missed, and the number of times that a use occurs has a strong influence on the way the entries are organized, which is different from the OED. Equally, the large group of texts called the corpus gives us reasonable grounds for omitting many uses and word forms that do not occur in it. It is difficult for a conventional dictionary to decide what to leave out, and a lot of quite misleading information is thus preserved in the tradition of lexicography, partly because these things are copied from dictionary to dictionary to dictionary. Not as an act of plagiarism, really, but because, well, if you haven't got a reliable database to work on, this seems like a likely thing to do. The first of these dictionaries was based on a corpus of 20 million words, which at that time was a huge number of words. Nowadays, it's close to around 500 million words, if I'm rightly informed. It's aimed at representing present-day, contemporary English in all its facets. Okay. And one of the explicit additions to the dictionary is that, and that's what you've been exposed to as learners as well, I'm sure, the explicit description of common collocations. So in a word like gap, well, you would then learn collocations, or you would get a list of collocations as a gap in the mountains, a gap in his upper teeth, a gap of 3 years, possibly something like a gap year, which is a very, very common thing to do for people before they start university, a huge gap in the record, a book that fills a major gap, a gap between rich and poor, a generation gap, etc. And the kind of, and seeing the importance in seeing a particular word in its context, and the context being basically part of the meaning of a word in some way or other. So, clearly a very, very long way from a list of hard words that I introduced about, I don't know, half an hour ago. Okay, that was a brief overview of dictionaries and the history of dictionaries in the context of, well, other developments also of the language, much less so than in the case of the Bible, but at least to some extent. And at this stage, sorry, this is all I have to say very early on. Enjoy the football and see you next week. Okay.